Morning. Good to see you all here. Such a beautiful day. It's easy to feel some lightness when the world is doing this. Yesterday I was here with a lot of friends for a retreat, and we did a lot of walking meditation outside, and it was really quite wonderful, and it was very quiet, except they were having boat races on the lake, just like this morning. I really thought, I'm going to bring an air horn to Rohatsu. Wake up! It was really the air horn. It was not separate from what we were doing. It wasn't. So, I'm going to give a talk today that I'm calling Mind Only, A Place for Practice. I gave a talk last week called Mind Only is Total Engagement. So, some of you probably heard that and some didn't. I'm going to talk a little bit about Mind Only in general. So, this will be sort of familiar to some of you, but if you read the Lankavatara Sutra, which is, according to legend, the only text that the founder of Zen used and carried, and which, I guess, before Zen was called Zen, it was usually called the Lankavatara School. The Lankavatara Sutra says about 150 times, you should know that everything is only mind. So, apparently repeating the idea of mind only is thought to be of some kind of value in this tradition. Now, the idea that everything is mind only could be very confusing, and it's wise to make sure we don't get confused. This is not about how you have like some superpowered mind, or no one else doesn't exist. Those are not good ideas, so don't have those. Mind only really suggests that what we know is experience. We know that we're having a momentary experience right now. That's ultimately all that we know. And everything that we know as a judgment about that experience is not ultimately true. It's just the result of the way we tend to look at our experience. So we have this experience right now. We think they're people. They're different from walls. I'm different from them. There's air horns and those don't belong at retreats. And so forth. But mind only invites us to just see there's just something happening here, and you don't know what it is. Oh, that was... I guess I've listened to a lot of Bob Dylan. Or as Vasubandhu states at the opening of his work, The 30 Verses on Consciousness Only, although he calls it 30 Verses on Projection Only, because he wants to make sure we don't start thinking that we have some kind of super consciousness. He wants us to remember that we're constantly projecting into our situation. He says, everything conceived as self or other occurs in the process of consciousness. So we have a process of consciousness, and it appears that there are things out there, and there's an us. And he's like, none of those things is ultimately true. There's just some kind of process going on here. And you might think, well, that's just weird. How's that going to help me? How's that going to help me, Ben? Well, the reason we have this kind of teaching is to point out the incredible degree to which our experience is governed by our own habits of mind. Our own habits of thinking, our own habits of viewing things, our own habits of emotional energy, and our own habits of behavior. Because if we realize the immensity of the power with which our own conditioning produces the experience of this moment, we realize the incredible importance and value of practicing to work with the way our mind creates this to make something beautiful, to make something compassionate, to make something helpful. This is making me think of my friend Mark in there, who sometimes give me some good Jung to think about. I'm going to try and quote some Jung, who says something that's similar. He says, until the unconscious becomes conscious, we will be controlled by it, and we will call it fate. I actually got this from Stacy, who made me think of Mark, because I have a lot of good friends. That made me think of Vasubandhu, who's one of my best friends, even though he died 1,800 years ago. He's in my heart. He's in my heart. He used his mind to try and show a way to transform the tendencies that we have into ones that are more beneficial. So, and of course, Jung's methodology and his understanding of unconscious are different than a traditional Buddhist one, but they have a lot of commonalities. And I'd argue we probably wouldn't have Western psychology if we didn't have Indian thought, which was doing psychology at least 3,000 or 4,000 years ago. Anyway, I gave a lot of examples last week of the degree to which our habits create our perception of the world, and I'm going to give a lot fewer this time, but it's much more than you might think. So I'm just going to give like one today. But first, can you guys hear me in there?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. But first I want to give a little teaching with a nice mind-only flavor by the Venerable Voramaya Kabila Singh was the first Thai woman to receive full ordination and receive the precepts. So women haven't been allowed to have full ordination in the Thai tradition for a couple thousand years, and recently they have been. So depending on the tendencies of your mind, that either makes you really angry or really hopeful, or maybe both. But, wow, so Voramaya Kabila Singh. First Thai woman to be ordained, which is pretty cool, I think. And when you get ordained in this tradition, you get to take 311 precepts. That is to say, you're supposed to remember and enact 300 instructions on how to conduct yourself, 311, which is a lot. Those of you taking the precepts here have like 13, and you probably think that's a lot. We keep it a little simpler. But anyway, a young man came and asked Voramaya Kabila Singh, how do you keep the 311 precepts? And she said, I just keep one precept. And he was pretty surprised. He said, what is that? She said, I just watch my mind. I just watch my mind. And I could probably digress on this subject for a long time, but there's an early Pali Canon Sutra where there's an argument between someone from another sect and Buddha, and the person from the other sect is saying the most important thing that you should focus on is your actions. And I understand that you, Buddha, teach that the most important thing is you should understand you should be focusing on training your mind. Although, you know, training your actions is really important in Buddhist thought as well. But he says the emphasis is on mind, is on intention. And they have this argument, and Buddha, basically it comes down to Buddha's like, everything you do comes out of the tendencies of your mind. The way you look at things, the way you feel about things, that's what drives all your behavior. So although you want to, you know, think about ways to do things that are helpful in an external form, you also really want to put a lot of emphasis on looking at how your mind is working, taking care of your mind. So, like I said, I gave a lot of examples of ways in which people's conditioning produces what they perceive. I'll just give one today. So there's been a number of studies where they took people who had witnessed crimes and they had them identify the people who they saw doing the crimes. And what they found is that to a pretty large degree, people are likely to say that the people they witnessed the crimes, witnessed someone doing a crime, think that person was black when they were not. Now, most of the examples I gave last week were of immediate perception, of people actually perceiving things in the moment that most of us would say are not there, having to do with their biases. But in this case, this is memory, which we often think, these people were not like, they could see it. You know, when you have a memory of an event, you see it. They saw a black person. This is just one example. So maybe the last couple of weeks I've been picking on racial bias, but because we have some good science on it. But guess what? The amount of biases we're not studying is outlandish. It's crazy. One of my students came in and said, I go to work a lot of times. I leave home. I get to work, and I realize I don't have any idea that I had an experience. Because they're so absorbed in thought. So, this teaching is about the fact that we can do something. But in order to be motivated to do something, you really got to understand that there's some reason to do it. So this teaching is, it helps us to let go of the idea that there's just external objects that we should be manipulating. Because, I guess, to put it simply, the idea is there aren't really external objects. There's phenomena. So this is phenomena. The difference being phenomena is something experienced. So there's things that are experienced. Things which are categorized as me, things that are categorized as someone else, things that are categorized as I don't like you, I love you, I want you, I'm trying to get rid of you, and so forth. But they're all just phenomena, stuff that's happening, and their happeningness is dependent on the way we view them. And we can transform the way we view them so we can liberate compassion. So what this is about is realizing that we have agency, that we can do something. What we can do in this tradition, we recommend compassionate action and meditation, both of which will transform the way we view things and what we do. So I'm going to talk about a koan. Koan, an ancient story of a conversation. This koan begins thus. Zhaozhu asked Nan Kuan, "What is the way?" Nan Kuan said, "Ordinary mind is the way." Zhaozhu asked Nan Kuan, "What is the way?" Nan Kuan said, "Ordinary mind is the way." So Zhaozhu and Nan Kuan are long gone, even though they're just living right here in this room with us. They were about 8th century Chinese Zen teachers. And Nan Kuan was a Dharma heir of Matsu. Matsu, who is known for famously, when someone asked Matsu, "What is Buddha?" Matsu said, "This very mind is Buddha. Mind only." Later on he said, "Buddha is not mind," so I want to make sure we stay straight here. Stay straight with our Zen style. So Nan Kuan is a ninth generation Zen ancestor. And Nan Kuan and Zhaozhu are both, they may be the two most cited teachers in all the records of Buddhism we have. Zhaozhu, I'm not sure, I didn't count, but it's pretty close. There's tons of stories of Zhaozhu's teaching. Likewise, more actually so than Nan Kuan. But here, Zhaozhu is a student. He's probably very young. And so you can just picture yourself going in to see Tim in Doksan. And you go, "What is the way?" And God knows what he would say. And you don't know what Nan Kuan would say. He just said it once. This isn't about, there's Gute, who always did the same thing when you asked him a question. But most Zen teachers say, "This mind is Buddha." And the next time they say, "It's not mind." Because they're responding to what's happening here, the phenomena that are here. Anyway, so these two guys are involved in a conversation which is central to how Zen was formed. Now, the record of Zen is principally the record of conversations between two people doing Zen. Two people doing Zen together and talking. I come from AA. That's how I got here. And what we say, am I not supposed to do that? I'm not in public, am I? Am I on the radio? Anyway, okay, so I'm a 12-step guy. Maybe I did something wrong there. Forgive me. I don't even know. Anyway, what's AA? One drunk talking to another.
That's what we say. It's one drunk talking to another.
And what do we say? Zen is one practitioner talking to another. And we could put this in lofty terms, as Bodhidharma did, supposedly, in the way the school was founded. It's direct mind-to-mind transmission. Or we could put this in the more embodied form, which feels more true to me in my work with my teacher, which is warm hand-to-warm hand transmission. But it's about being together. It's about just being together. And a lot of the being together is not conducted with speech, but some of it is speech, and speech can be really helpful. You know, and I don't really know how it works. I don't know. I've gone in to see Tim about a couple hundred times or something in the course of my life, and if he has a method, I don't know what it is. But what I know is I just keep going because it seems to have been beneficial, and when I go in, I usually leave with some lightness. I don't really know why. And that's fine. I know that it seems like both of us just try and be as present as possible. And something happens there. So koan discourse has this flavor of not knowing I'm pointing to in general. So I don't know how many people here have read koans, but a number of you have certainly encountered some. And we must all agree that they tend to be kind of weird, right? I just can't resist reading this poem that Wayne, are you here? Wayne Moskowitz pointed this out during a morning study group once. This poem is slightly snarky, but it does point to something about the way that we want to view text, and certainly the way we want to view koans and poetry. And the best thing about this just happened to be sitting on my table because there's someone who prints poems and puts them around the neighborhood, and someone brought it home. I thought, I'll read this at my dharma. I'm just going to read this once, folks, so dive in. Introduction to Poetry, Billy Collins. I asked them to take a poem and hold it up to the light, like a color slide, or press an ear against its hive. I say drop a mouse into a poem and watch him probe his way out, or walk inside the poem's room and feel around on the walls for a light switch. I want them to water ski across the surface of a poem, waving at the author's name on the shore. But all they want to do is tie the poem to a chair with a rope and torture a confession out of it. They begin beating it with a hose to find out what it really means. So it's a little snarky. But it shows something, not really just about the way we view poetry, but about the way we view koans, but about the way we view life. There's something magical happening here, unlimited. And we're like, I'm gonna get this thing. I'm going to get this right. I'm going to get there on time. I'm going to get what I want done. And it's like, it's about as fun as tying something up to a chair a lot of the times. And I don't know, how is it for the world? How is it for the world? We can let it free. Well, let's go water ski together instead. Jiaju asked Nanquan, what is the way? Nanquan says, ordinary mind is the way. What is the way? So the character, the Chinese character used to express way here is Dao, you know, like Taoism. But that character gets used to mean a lot of things. Most characters in Chinese have a lot of meanings. They proliferate meaning. In fact, they use, Chinese language is much more conducive to water skiing than tying up, if I could put it that way. Here, I'll just say the way, so it's a path. It's a path, and sometimes it would be translated as the path. And the path here means both the actual liberated path already, Or what? Like he's asking, what's Buddha? What's the whole truth? How can we realize this totality of connection to everything in total peace right now? That's an easy question for your teacher. Try that one. But it also means the way that you practice. The way that you practice. What you choose to do. What should I do? What is the way? Which way should I go? There's one story. I may remember this. The student says, I'm sick of this. And the teacher says, okay, you can go. That's okay. I'm leaving the monastery. He gets up and he goes to the door and he's about to leave. And the teacher says, that door won't work. And then he goes to the other door and the teacher says, that door won't work. What is the way? Teacher says, the way, just come back. Hey, I think we can figure this out. Just stay with me a little longer. So, and actually there's a beautiful Pali Canon Sutra called Synonyms for Nirvana where Buddha goes through this exhaustive list, and they tend to be things like liberation, peace. Those liberation, peace, I'll say those. But it also says it's the way, it's the path leading to liberation, which those of you who know a lot about Buddhism may be going, whoa, no way. Buddha said nirvana is the path leading to liberation. Well, if you don't know why that's crazy, that's all right. I'm not going there. But it certainly sounds pretty Mahayana. Normally, we say early Buddhism says the path leads you to another place, which is nirvana, or another nowness. But, it's a deep tradition. So anyway, he said, what's the way? And Jiaju says, ordinary mind is the way. So Jiaju says, should I direct my mind towards it? Sounds like a good idea. And Nanquan says, if you direct yourself towards it, you will become separate from it. That's why we all think Zen is a bummer. What are we doing here? What is this? Jiaju says, if I don't direct myself, how can I know the Tao? A 19-year-old guy talking to his teacher, I just want liberation. What are you asking me to do here? If ordinary mind is the way, and I'm not going to do something about it, how's that going to work? What is the way? Ordinary mind is the way. Should I direct my mind towards it? If you direct your mind towards it, you will become separate from it. How can I know the Tao if I don't direct myself? Nanquan says, the Tao is not subject to knowing or not knowing. The way is not subject to knowing or not knowing. Knowing is delusion. Not knowing is blankness. If you really reach the genuine Tao, it will be as vast and boundless as outer space. How can we talk about this at the level of right and wrong? Hearing this, Jiaju experienced sudden realization. Vast and boundless as outer space. Maybe I'll come back to that theme in a minute. So anyway, in the mind-only tradition, they posit two barriers to liberated compassion. The barrier of afflictive emotion and the barrier of delusion. And they recommend two practices to deal with those two barriers. Mindfulness of the senses and the emotions to deal with the barrier of afflictive emotion. And non-dual meditation to deal with the barrier of delusion. The barrier of delusion basically meaning any kind of thinking that thinks it knows that something is a thing. There's a lot of thinking. In case you haven't picked up on that. So anyway, we have two barriers. We have two practices. And mindfulness of the senses and the emotions and non-dual meditation. So probably everyone here has some sense of mindfulness of the senses and emotion, just being deeply attuned to what we're experiencing, these phenomena, in the body, in the eyes, sound of whatever machine that is out the window humming away. And non-dual meditation is much more puzzling. So non-duality means different things to different people. Let me try and make a simple way of putting it, which is not perfect, but non-duality is about seeing connection rather than separation, or maybe seeing that any separation that you see isn't ultimately true. So the separation between yourself and other people, or that sound, and your experience of it. Because when we start to see through those separations, the connection we feel liberates our compassion. To put this in the simplest ways I can. And, you know, we get some instructions for non-dual meditation, which is confusing. So we might say it's objectless meditation. So we call it, say, shikantaza, or just sitting. We're not trying to get somewhere other than here. But we're not just trying to be here either, because we're already here. So how could you try and do that? So when we talk about non-duality, language just keeps having to flip on itself, because everything a language says is inherently dualistic. So that's why Zen discourse tends to say, this very mind is Buddha. Mind is not Buddha. Because we create dualities, we find a way to kind of soften our sense of duality, and then we... Dogen tries to help us out, thank you, in his instructions for Zazen, which is really one of the pinnacles of instructions on non-dual meditation. He starts off by saying, give up the operations of mind, intellect, and consciousness. Stop measuring things with thoughts, ideas, and views, and have no designs on becoming a Buddha. No problem. Then he talks about the body a lot. And then he says, think not thinking. What is that, non-thinking? Which, I'm not even going to get into what that's about, but you can see this non-dual inversion of language is wrapped up in there. So non-dual meditation is complex, but we give a flavor of it here when we teach meditation. In fact, when we, our Zazen instruction here, what it says and the thing that we train people with is we teach mindfulness of breath with the flavor of shikantaza. So how I do that, as I said, and we spend a lot of time talking about just being with the experience of the body and the breath. And then towards the end, I say this is not about trying to attain something. It's not about trying to create something. It's not about trying to make something happen. It's not about trying to be someone that you're not. It's not about trying to make some special state of mind. So, anyway, these two practices are what Mind Only really recommends to deal with the tendency to have these emotions that come up which make a cloud our thinking. I mean, really, think about how well you think when you're really mad. I just don't think, you know, it's like, I'm just going to wait a day, and then I do much better. So I can take care of my anger with some mindfulness. So both of these practices, all these practices are deeply rooted in the body. And this is true through, by the way, you might be like, how did we get here? We got here because Jaju thinks, I'm going to direct myself towards it. That's mindfulness. I'm going to direct my mind. He says, should I be mindful of my ordinary mind? And Nakwan says, if you're mindful of it, you'll become separate from it. So Jaju says, should I do mindfulness? And Nakwan says, no, you should do non-dual meditation. Okay, by the way, I hope this means 87,000 other things to everyone else who ever talks about this. But that's where I'm going with this, all right? So anyway, because these guys know Buddhism, they know Buddhism. In fact, they can express aspects of the tradition in one word that it takes me a week. So, this whole thing, though, is rooted in the body. So in the Pali Canon, the main instruction on practicing Zazen, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness Sutra, the first foundation is mindfulness of body. And there's a bunch of different mindfulness of body practices, but the first one, and the one that's foundational to all meditation practices in the tradition, mindfulness of breath. Stay close to the breath. I keep coming back to Tim here today, but I was talking to Tim not too long ago, and we're both just saying, well, I'm not even sure what kind of practice I do, really. But then we both say, well, we both just stay close to the breath. We stay close to the breath. That's one thing that's there. Also posture, just being aware. Not so much in Zen we emphasize this upright posture, which is not very natural to me. But in early Buddhism, you know, are you walking? Are you standing? Are you sitting? Are you lying down? Really, no. We don't know a lot of the time. Like my student who's like, yeah, I go to work. He doesn't know he's sitting in a car. He does not know what his body is doing in that state when he's absorbed so much in thought that he's completely cut off from life and everyone else and the vast unlimitedness that's available in every moment. Which he tells me he finds too sometimes. So. Of course, in Zen, they've got the tradition of mindful work. So people started really focusing on doing work with their bodies as the locus of practice, a principal locus of practice. And we do this stuff here. I managed to skip for the first year in a while putting in the air conditioning. But I've done some mindful work with Busho here, putting in the air conditioning. Well, it was somewhat mindful. Thanks to my friends Dave and Jeremy who put it in. And in Soto Zen, we have this emphasis on Soto Zen form, which we only do here during morning Zazen, Monday through Saturday, and during Sesshin, but where we have a bunch of formal things that we do. We bow at the door. When we come in a very specific way, we bow at the door, we step in. Now I can't remember because I'm not doing it. With the left foot? The left foot. When you leave, you bow in shashu, and you step out with the... Well, actually, you step out and bow. So, but there's... I'm not being very clear, but whatever. My body does it. That's because I learned it in my body, not my mind. And we bow at the cushion. All these activities are just to draw awareness into the body in harmony with other people. So both of these practices, actually non-dual meditation, Dogen's instructions on how to do non-dual meditation are profoundly and deeply based in the body. He says, give up the operations of mind, intellect, and consciousness. Stop measuring things with thoughts, ideas, and views. Have no designs on becoming a Buddha. And then he talks for like 16 sentences on how to hold your body, which I won't go through, but he just talks about how to hold your body. Non-dual meditation is intimately connected to body. Likewise, mindfulness, body. So body awareness is the root of all mind-only practice, which may sound weird, but the thing is, our body is mind-only because our mind-only is body. They're not separate. By deeply attuning to the body, we find connection. So Jiaju, he hears... What is the way? Ordinary mind is the way. He says, oh, should I direct my mind towards it? Cool. I'm going to be mindful of my mind. I'm going to look at it and see what it's doing. This is a good thing to do. I'm sorry, Nanquan. But the thing is, Nanquan is just giving instruction to one guy at one time. Zen koans are not about elucidating an ultimate truth. They're about water skiing. They're about feeling around for the light switch. They're about dropping a mouse into a bottle. Well, that's not very nice. A maze with some food. Maybe? Okay. But Nanquan emphasizes the second side. If you direct yourself towards it, you'll become separate from it. And this is the normal Zen critique. This becomes emphasized in Zen, that mindfulness practice actually creates separation because we're fostering the observing of another thing. I'm going to observe my body. I'm going to observe the feeling. However, I think integrating both is the best. And that's what mind-only teachings say in general. Early Buddhist teachings emphasize mindfulness. Mahayana and Zen teachings emphasize non-dual meditation or something more in that vein. I think both. I think both. This is the practice I was taught to do here. And this is the way I do it. But Nanquan is the teacher here, and so he's going to show us something. He says, if you direct yourself towards it, you'll become separate from it. And then Jiaju shows us his heart. He says, he's frustrated. If I don't direct myself, how can I know the way? Some of us may know this feeling. You're sitting here, what am I even doing here? This is weird. I mean, it's been several hours since I've had this feeling, but
is weird.
But then Nanquan goes on to say, knowing is delusion, not knowing is blankness. Knowing is delusion. That's just a hard one to take in. Knowing is delusion. If you've been around Zen a while, you probably think, sweet, yeah, I knew that. I got this one. I know about it. I know about it.
There we go again. Knowing things. I got it figured out.
So then we get most people I know, one of their favorite koans is the one that ends up where the guy says, not knowing is most intimate. Mm-hmm. And we all go, oh, we Zen people go, oh, yes. This is my practice, to shed all my preconceptions, to just arrive here, to offer my life to what is. When this happens, I know the liberation that's there. It's beautiful. And Nanquan is just mean. Not knowing is blankness. He's just saying, don't get stuck on that too. You got to know stuff. If you don't know anything, how can you get up and actually, you know, go to a meeting? How can you get up and vote? How can you get up and figure out how to give your money to someone who needs it? No side is going to be the one side. If you really reach the genuine Tao, you will find it as vast and boundless as outer space. Limitless. Last week I read very briefly from the Avatamsaka Sutra. And then the Avatamsaka Sutra is, if you want something that's about unlimitedness, it's a very influential sutra. And I should have brought it. It's fun to just improv the flavor. The Buddha sat on a lotus calyx in a field of 1,000 lotus flowers. And in each lotus flower sat another Buddha, each one radiating the light of 1,000,000 suns from every pore in their body. And within the light of every one of those 1,000,000 suns was 1,000,000 lotuses floating on clouds of Dharma rain, which rained down on all the people. And every drop of rain in the lotus flowers illuminated the universe with the light reflected from the 1,000,000 suns, from every Buddha, and in every drop was the reflection. Okay. And it just goes on. It just goes on. And I read this and I go, wow. Unlimitedness. You will find this as vast and boundless as outer space. It is. Look around. Every single detail of this experience is vast beyond knowing. There's someone who studies paint chips. They put a whole, you can take one paint chip off that, and there's unlimited engagement for weeks. Oh, look at the materials in this. Wow. Wow. Every mind and every heart in here, every pain that people have carried in here, and every joy. Vast, just in this room. This is a tiny room. We're in a little house. We're together in a little house. Connected to infiniteness. And the mind, in its knowing, thinks, oh, yeah. Get the right thing on time. And in its not knowing, how can it really reach out and learn? Like, oh, wow. When I buy this thing, this is what happens to the people who made it. When I just go through my life in this normal American consumerist fashion, this is what happens to the world outside. We could easily miss that. So this ability to know and liberate compassion has to include knowing. Hearing this, Jaju experienced sudden realization. Sweet! All right, everybody sign up for Dokusan. We got like half a dozen teachers here. I'm going to see 10 Dokusans tomorrow. Sudden realization. I don't know. It's a story. It's a story, but what does it show? It shows that in meeting and having a conversation that was immediate, that dealt with practice, something beautiful happened. Some connection was made. judge whose realization is not something that's separate from Nanquan, or from you, or from knowing, or not knowing, or the way, or directing the mind, or not directing the mind. Ordinary mind is the way. Just whatever this is. What is this ordinary mind? It includes just our churning little thinky thingy that we do. But ordinary mind also includes that glow of light up there, the million suns of the Buddha hanging from that little thing above you guys' heads. It includes the sound of the lawnmower. All phenomena perceived as self or other, conceived as self or other, occur in the transformation of consciousness, ordinary mind. A place to practice. You can do this practice of non-dual meditation. Do this practice of being mindful of the body, the senses, the emotions. There's only one time we can do it. It's always that time. Right now. Opportunity is infinite, unlimited. The realization, unlimited. Thank you. Well, I would like to invite other voices, either observations, comments, questions, expressions of your heart.
I got a question about the... Because what you said about the two practices, non-dual meditation and then just mindfulness of body and emotion, makes a lot of sense. And so when we're dealing with a collective emotion, what's recommended is mindfulness of body and collective emotion. Do you have a sense of why that's more effective? And I'm just thinking, as it shows up in my practice, it's kind of by nature blurry in that if I have a collective emotion on the cushion during zazen, it becomes part of non-dual practice. If I have off the cushion, I'm more likely to go to body and mind of the emotion. So obviously there's overlap. Do you have a sense of why they're emphasizing that?
I do, yeah. Yeah, and actually you're, I think we may have hung out together a little bit, because your understanding of how to do the practice is pretty much the way I do and teach it, which is in meditation I mostly am just kind of letting all phenomena be what they are.
Yeah.
And I practice mindfulness of afflictive emotion much more in the outside world. My ability to be aware of it is heightened by my practice here. But I'm much more likely to get all, you know, out there. So anyway, why? It seems kind of practical. Non-dual meditation is dealing directly with the barrier of delusion, which is dualistic thinking. So you can see that seems kind of clear. And of course they relate and feed each other. But there's something just particularly powerful about deeply seeing certain kinds of mind states, you know, emotions. And I think most of us have just experienced this, so I don't have a very technical answer here, except that I think that the reason that the two barriers model and these two matching practices went up is I think Yogacarans, of which Vasubandhu is one, perceived that the Mahayana was going so far into the side of this non-dual stuff that they were not dealing with their afflictive emotions in the very effective way. So we say, early Buddhism says, dispassion, working with your emotions so you become dispassionate. And then that language starts to fade a little bit in the Mahayana. And I think you do see people who, because they don't do any of the... I'm more likely to be around a lot of non-dual practice. And it's like, if you're not doing any of the focusing on taking care of the emotions, you can kind of not even notice that they're driving things. So, whereas I think, you know, also he thought, like, from a Theravadan perspective, they weren't getting free enough. You know, it's like they were... So, I don't know if that's a helpful answer,
it's
but
very helpful. Thank you. Yes. Thank you, Ben, for your help. So knowing and not knowing. Of course, the Western idea is the dualistic one, and it has a couple thousand year history. And who knows where it started? But
you should talk real loud so they can hear in you.
So the dualistic version of knowing is the Western tradition. Basically, it has started several thousand years ago, and as I understand it, anyway, one of the things that was part of this process was, there were people who were trying to investigate the world and figure out how it worked. So, at various stages, somebody would discover a way of building a gadget. They would measure something. They would measure time. They would measure mass. They would measure something, you know, some quantity. You could put a number on it. And that information, that knowledge got shared by this community of people who were investigating this problem. And other people adopted that method of measuring things and started proposing ideas, explaining what's going on in the world and trying to build other gadgets which did other things. And of course, the latest example of this is the gadget that just blew out the Pluto and sent them back to us on Earth so we can look at them. So, one of the reasons I liked your talk, especially, was because of your example. Because that example comes from this Western tradition. How do I put these two together?
Oh, yeah. So, you're kind of like science.
Yes.
Yeah, well, they work together pretty well. You know, I shouldn't go too far down this road, but most Buddhist thought does not say that the idea, basically it says you can't make real metaphysical claims. And science is to some degree sort of based on one, that you can observe things and measure them. But it doesn't, Buddhist thought says, cool, if you have a way of using the mind that works and helps, go ahead and use it that way, but don't get stuck. So we have the most famous one we have of this is when the guy asked Buddha, something about what should I do with the teaching, and he says, well, once you're liberated, put it down. If you make a raft to get across a river, you don't, it, actually it's one of the few funny Pali Canon sutras, he says, don't, would you put it on your back and carry it around with you? So the thing is, sometimes we're going to put science on our back. You know, I heard someone here on the porch, they were saying, when I drink coffee in the afternoon, I can't sleep at night. And the other guy was a scientist who I really love, and he's got a lot, he's very insightful. But at the time, he said, well, caffeine only has effect for 4 hours, so that couldn't make you not be able to sleep. Which, if anyone has experienced any anxiety, you know that anxiety is a heightened heart rate. And if anything triggers that heightened heart rate, it can feed on itself. The systems are super complex. Super complex. So science is cool, and it's like, wow, you know, it's good, study the mind, see how this is working, but it's not like an ultimate truth, just like Buddhism is an ultimate truth.
I guess my question was directed at understanding the effects of my actions when I live as an average American consuming things in the world, and how do I know the effects of my actions? And what I'm arguing for is that in addition to mind-only practice, we need to critically look at our situation in the society in order to make intelligent and correct and compassionate choices.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, but, and that wouldn't, I wouldn't think of, that's not separate from mind-only practice because it's your mind doing a thing. That's all it says. So that thing that you should do with your mind is figure out how to help people, how you're harming people. That's a basic, that's one of the central things we want to be doing with this mind, for sure, is figure out how to help people. Figure out how you're not doing that. That's what we're trying to see how much we fail to do that, see how much we succeed, and just be encouraged that we have impact. It really matters. So that's my view.
Might be off the topic a little bit, but you were talking about meditation,
ordinary mind realization here, complete knowledge. It's not what I'm looking for necessarily. But I find that when I practice, when I come here and sit in a group, sometimes I get more of a feeling of lightness or beauty or power, whatever the feeling is, afterwards. Whereas at home, that doesn't happen to the same degree. And is that an illusion? Or is something to that? You know, I'm just curious. I don't know if other people experience that. But,
well,
I do, and I'm not sure why.
So he's saying he's just noticing when he comes and sits with the group, there's more lightness that comes into his practice, which I experience too. The likelihood that I'm going to tell someone from this seat that they're deluded is pretty low. But then on the other hand, it's all delusion. Knowing is delusion. Wow! But but it's experience. Your experience is real. Your experience is real and valid and important. This is about really knowing your own heart. So yes, if you notice that, that's cool. I notice that. That's why I come here. I'd probably just be sitting at my house right now. But if I hang out with you guys, I feel some lightness. If I can have a conversation with you. So I don't think, I mean, sure, it's delusion if you want to think of it in one way, all thought is delusion. Or, no, it's not a delusion. It's like, duh, this is how we do this. This is why we have Sangha. This is why we're all here. Because we hold each other up. So, thank you all very much. Very nice to be with you.